If you're looking for the quietest place in Kansas City, consider the Missouri Valley Special Collections Room at the Central Branch of the Kansas City Public Library. Except when the clock strikes, or someone's shuffling files looking for a rare book or record. Librarian Jeremy Druin says he doesn't discourage talking.
We're not a quiet room, but we do try to keep it quiet for our researchers here. We get a lot of people come in here, and they have an idea of what they're looking for, but we really have to communicate with them, talk with them, learn about their research so that we can maybe look for those hidden gems in the back that might not show up in our catalog or might not show up on our website.
Okay, so it's not a silent room. The librarians do speak, in hushed tones, with researchers as they arrived. But if you haven't been to the Missouri Valley Collections of the Kansas City Public Library, it's on the fifth floor, and it does feel worlds away from hustle and bustle. The lamplight is warm and low, and the nerdy camaraderie goes unspoken. For researchers, this is a treasure trove of documents. But for the average citizen, what's probably more interesting about the room is that it gathers a huge collection of books all about local history in one place. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we're taking on a similar project. We're collecting your wisdom on local history. Know of a great book exploring an incident or character from our city's past? Call us up. The number is 816-235-2888. We're kicking off today's show by chatting with Kevin Fox Gotham. He's the author of Race, Real Estate, and Uneven Development, The Kansas City Experience 1900 to 2000. The second edition, stretching that end date to 2010, has just been published. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
So you're a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans. Where did your interest in race and development in Kansas City come from? How did you get interested in this subject originally?
Yeah, it's kind of a long story, but it begins really about 20 years ago when I was a graduate student at the University of Kansas in the sociology department. And I was exploring some of the scholarly research that was coming out in the late 1980s and early 1990s about the transformation of U.S. metropolitan areas in the post-World War II period, largely the concentration of African-American poverty and the mass suburbanization of white residents, and looking at cities in the Northeast and Midwestern parts of the United States, and in particular looking at how patterns of racial residential segregation had changed. And I got interested in just the case study of Kansas City because Kansas City had followed this pattern of mass suburbanization and concentration of African-American poverty, and it was ranked as one of the nation's top dozen or so metropolitan areas in patterns of segregation. So I was interested in, you know, what had happened in Kansas City with respect to suburbanization and poverty, and also probably more importantly, why it had become one of the nation's leading segregated cities and metropolitan areas.
So what's the short answer to that question? Why are we in that top 12? I mean, it's a dubious honor for sure.
Yeah, the short answer to that, I would say there's largely three things, and I'll give you the short answer. You know, after the Second World War II, Kansas City embarked on a large-scale urban renewal and highway building activity that displaced tens of thousands of people from the downtown area and largely funneled a large number of people into the housing market. Secondly, after the Second World War, and especially after the mid-1950s, schools in the metropolitan area moved away from explicit discrimination and segregation to more of a covert form of segregation, and especially after the Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education Supreme Court decision. And then finally, I would say the third point was after the 1950s or so, there was a wave of real estate blockbusting that occurred in the southeastern part of Kansas City, Missouri, especially in the area west or east of Troost Avenue, which basically pushed whites out of the city and created what I would refer to as a very rigid and tenacious form of segregation in Kansas City, Missouri. So that's kind of the short three major factors responsible for post-World War II segregation.
I want to talk to you more about what you you just summarized, you call it the Troost Wall. I want to talk to you more about that in a second, but I'm curious that the name J.C. Nichols did not come up in what you just said.
Yeah, J.C. Nichols was one real estate official among largely a vast industry or a vast nationwide sector that was important for understanding suburbanization and land use patterns from the 1920s, you know, and later. And so in my book, I tend not to zero in on individuals as responsible for patterns of discrimination and segregation. While they are certainly important, I'm more interested in the kinds of key actors, organized interests, and most importantly, extra-local or societal processes that were responsible for segregation, not just in Kansas City, but in cities in the northeast and midwestern part of the United States, because much of what happened in Kansas City was replicated in other cities. So J.C. Nichols was part of a larger nationwide network of real estate agents and brokers and financial interests that we're all working together through different kinds of political action committees, through various kinds of other industry committees through their actions and activities help to kind of forge the patterns of segregation and poverty that we saw emerge and develop after the Second World War.
The East and West of Troost division that you just kind of summarized earlier has gotten a lot of attention. You've called it the Troost Wall. Most people in Kansas City can just hear that phrase and have some sense of what it's meant by it. But what specifically do you mean by it, dubbing it the Troost Wall?
Yeah, so when I was writing the book and actually the dissertation, then the book and years ago, I became interested in why, when you look at Census Bureau data, why Troost Avenue became such a rigid and tenacious racial dividing line in the city, that when you look at census data there, even through the 2010 census data, there are no census tracts west of Troost Avenue that are over 50% African-American or minority, whereas the census tracts east of Troost Avenue are overwhelmingly African-American and Hispanic. And so I became interested in, basically why that particular street became the Mason-Dixon line of Kansas City after especially in the 1940s and especially in the 1950s and later. And so, you don't have too many cities where particular streets become this culturally significant and racially significant racial dividing line. And so I have an entire chapter of the book that focuses on the how and the why of Kansas City's Mason-Dixon line, that is Troost Avenue.
You outline a few ways in which your approach to this issue differs from previous scholarship on race and real estate development in American cities. And some of what was novel in your approach when the first edition came out is a little more mainstream now, but this point interests me. Rather than viewing the relationship between discrimination and housing segregation as a clear-cut case of cause and effect, with discrimination as the cause and segregation as the effect, you establish a more reciprocal relationship and identify discrimination as something with its own separate causes, with its own causes, not just as a cause of other things.
Yeah, that's a very, very important point. And so that particular point, as I develop in especially the first chapter, and then elaborate on in subsequent chapters, really ties into a major debate that goes back to the 1960s and before, and that is the argument that patterns of segregation develop as a result of racial discrimination. Now, intuitively, you think that that might be the case, that you cannot have racially segregated neighborhoods and schools and so on unless you have racial discrimination being practiced by particular groups of people. And so I kind of problematize that by basically saying and providing data to illustrate this, is that if you look at Kansas City's patterns of segregation, especially in the 1930s and 20s and before, Kansas City was not a segregated city. You had a great deal of racial mixing by blacks and whites and other racial groups in the city and to a lesser extent the region. And so even back then, we know that racial discrimination was considered something that was basically practiced all the time by different groups of people, that racial hostility, racial prejudice, racial violence, as forms of discrimination readily took place and were well documented going back to the 19th century and before. So my basic question was, given that we had these patterns of instances of racial discrimination and hostility and violence, why did they not translate into segregated housing patterns? Whereas after the 1940s and 50s, and especially after the 1960s, with the outlawing of explicit discrimination, why do racial segregation patterns remain so strikingly tenacious and persistent? And my kind of takeaway from this, and my point is that you could not have racially segregated neighborhoods and regions and subdivisions unless you had a particular housing market that actually was institutionalizing racial discrimination into its normal activities and operations. And so even to this day, as I point out in latter chapters, you have racial discrimination being practiced in a very subtle and covert way through the basic operations and activities of real estate agents, not just in Kansas City, but elsewhere. So much of my point in the book, to kind of finalize this real quick, is to kind of problematize a simple relationship between discrimination and segregation, that segregation can take place in the absence of overt discrimination by individuals, that discriminate or segregation can take place just by through the simple buying and selling of homes in a particular housing market.
So you also established your own kind of definition for racism and addressed the idea that people talk a lot about racism without necessarily having a shared idea of what that term means. What is your definition, the working definition in your book, of what that term means?
I tend to use the term racialization, which is a process whereby particular institutions, particular neighborhoods, particular parts of cities become known by groups of people for their racial status, given that they might have particular racial groups that inhabit those spaces and so on. And so I talk about what kind of I refer to the book as the racialization of space, which is where you see these pockets of segregation emerge in Kansas City in the 1920s and later. And then by the time we get up to the 1970s, we're really talking about an entire metropolitan area that is very racialized, that people associate particular parts of the city and particular parts of the metropolitan area on racial lines, and they use racial language, sometimes racially coded language, to refer to those places either as places of high status and prestige, or places to be of high crime, places to be avoided, places of violence, and so on. And so the term racialization, I see it, and other scholars have used this term, as a more nuanced way of understanding how patterns of segregation can emerge and develop and continue in the absence of explicit and overt racial discrimination and prejudice.
So the second edition of your book adds 10 years of what we might hope would be progress to this story. What happened in 2000 to 2010 that inspired you to update this book?
Well, a couple of things. First, the publisher, my publisher, State University of New York Press, called me and asked me if I'd be interested in updating the book, given that there had been some changes that occurred not just in Kansas City, but in just housing markets around the United States in general. We had the subprime mortgage crisis and a larger real estate and housing meltdown that occurred after 2007 and 2008. And one thing in particular about Kansas City was, according to the 2010 census data, that patterns of segregation had declined dramatically from 2000 to 2010. And, you know, my publisher was kind of interested in understanding the how and the why of that. And so I basically tried to update some of the points in the book using the 2010 census data. And, that just went forward from there.
Any little snippet that we might find interesting from that 2010 census data that you're willing to share? Say, we'll save
yeah.
the rest for the reading.
Yeah, this guy, one really interesting tidbit I came across that was kind of interesting to me, really interesting to me, and because it does connect with the chapter on the Troost Wall, and that is when we look at 2010 census data. Well, let me kind of back up a decade. If we look at 2000 and even 1990 census data, every Kansas City, Missouri neighborhood where black residents were more than half the population was east of Troost Avenue. And this pattern continued in 2000 and 2010. When I was looking at the 2010 census data, I saw that there are no census tracts west of Troost Avenue that are over 50% black. So basically, as in 1990 and as in 2000, in the year 2000, all the census tracts currently west of Troost Avenue are majority white. And this figure suggests the durability and tenacity of Troost Avenue as a kind of racial dividing line in Kansas City, Missouri. So what's interesting here is that you still have Troost Avenue and largely city neighborhoods that are very segregated, whereas on a more regional metropolitan scale, patterns of segregation are becoming less rigid over time.
So, your original research included interviews to keep human concerns at the front and center in the pages of your book. Did you check back in on the people you met in the 1990s when you revisited the story of Kansas City?
I talked with a few of them, yes.
What had changed in their lives? And what did that tell you?
There were 2 points. First, there were people who basically felt that there hadn't been much change at all, that there that the problems of racial discrimination and racial segregation, of poverty, inequality, that those had remained basically the same. There hadn't been much change at all in the last 10 years or so. Last 10 to 20 years or so. And then there were those who, so in the first group, they were very pessimistic and cynical about the future. The second group of people I talked with were more optimistic about the future. They saw that while there were still problems in the city and metropolitan area with respect to race and inequality and segregation, that there had been some progress over time with respect to school desegregation. And other form that and other forms of other policies that seem to help revitalize the downtown. And so they seem to be more optimistic and less pessimistic than the first group. So I don't want to say it was polarized. There was some complexity and nuance there, but that was largely the kind of the way people I originally interviewed in the 1990s saw the changes in the last 10 to 15 years. There were a group of people that saw positive changes, and there were a group of people that saw hardly any change over time.
We're going to be switching gears just a little bit shortly to give our listeners some recommendations on local history books. I assume you'd put your own book on that list, but any other books you've stumbled upon in your research that you think are either fabulously written or crucial for understanding Kansas City, ideally both?
I've always enjoyed Bob Worley's work on J.C. Nichols. There's more than a few books on J.C. Nichols that are pretty good kind of individual biographies of him. I haven't really kept up on Kansas City history in the last 5 years or so, so it's really difficult for me to identify particular books that strike me as really high quality books. I would say that the references in my books in my book cites the what I consider the best kinds of books on Kansas City, at least the ones I perceive as important for understanding the larger kind of metropolitan development of Kansas City.
Kevin Fox Gotham, thanks so much for talking with me this morning.
Thank you.
Kevin Fox Gotham is the author of Race, Real Estate, and Uneven Development, now in its second edition.